Is the Trump administration's abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro a departure from U.S. policy? Or is it just the latest iteration of a long-held doctrine? And what does Maduro's fall from power mean for Cuba? This week on Upfront, I'll be asking those questions to scholar of U.S. Latin America relations and senior analyst at the National Security Archive, Peter Kornbluh. Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for joining me in Upfront.
It's a great pleasure to be here, really.
You've studied the region for decades. You've written and thought extensively about the United States' relationship to Latin America. How surprised were you on January 3rd when U.S. forces bombed Caracas and abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro?
Well, I'll tell you the honest truth. I was not surprised to see that happen because President Trump had been telegraphing that that's what he was going to do for months, including murdering one after another the crews of these small fast boats in the Caribbean, and then putting snuff films up on into social media to celebrate the killing of one small crew after another. Through obliteration of drones and bombs, et cetera. And that was a message to Maduro. We're going to do the same thing to you. He openly said, I'm sending the CIA into Venezuela. He let it be known that they were drafting a legal opinion which would allow him to assassinate Maduro. So I was not surprised that they went in and did that. I'll tell you what surprised me, though. The press conference that morning in which Trump and his national security team literally openly said, this is our right to do this. This is not about democracy. This is not about human rights. This is about seizing Venezuela's oil. And we're going to take over Venezuela now. Trump basically proclaimed himself, as he would later post on social media, the acting president of Venezuela.
The world responded. Almost to a person, the international community said, this is illegal. It's a gross violation of international law. Unfortunately, Trump, like many other leaders of his sort, don't put much stock in international law. So help me think about the domestic piece of this. What do you make of the legality of this operation under U.S. law?
Well, the truth is that was the point of the press conference, to say the law doesn't apply to us, neither domestic law or international law. We are doing this because we have the might to do it. It's raw power. And it was the display of power in and of itself that seemed to appeal to Trump, not any particular goal outside of finally controlling Venezuela's vast oil fields. On the domestic side, of course, the administration was obliged to tell Congress before it conducted such operations under the War Powers Act, and it did not do so. And so that was
Walk me through that a little bit, because Trump's argument was this was a strike. It's not an act of war, it's a strike, and presidents have the ability to make strikes.
Yeah, the problem is he's convoluted and tied himself in a knot with all the semantics about trying to put a fig leaf of legitimacy on this. So he claimed we're in a war on drugs. And Maduro's a narco-terrorist. This was all kind of made up. But because he's a terrorist, that gives us the ability under the rules of fighting terrorism to go in and do a strike. But in fact, then, of course, he's using the entire U.S. military. That was the biggest gathering of U.S. military armada forces in the Caribbean in decades, I think, since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And so it was certainly was on war footing. And so, you know, the point is that he was clear. Law doesn't apply to me. He has now said, I don't need international law. All I need is my own personal morality. And of course,
and his mind. Don't forget his mind.
Yeah, well, both of those things are on display as we speak. And I think both the entire world and a good part of the United States of America has come to question what's going on in that mind. And I can say clearly, he obviously doesn't have any morality.
I want to revisit this narco-terrorism conversation because, again, Trump's argument, at least in part, was this was a law enforcement operation. It was a warrant that needed to be served. This was an arrest that needed to be made because there's a drug operation here and we are trying to hold someone accountable for a violation of domestic law. This idea of narco-terrorism is being used not just in this case, it seems, but as a security rationale throughout Latin America.
Once you declare somebody a terrorist in the post 9/11 world, the United States gets to operate kind of supposedly under a kind of a different set of rules than the traditional war combat rules. For one thing, that enabled Trump to say, you know, I can assassinate Maduro because we do have the latitude to assassinate terrorists before they strike us, as opposed to common criminals like a drug dealer on the streets of New York City. You wouldn't be able to just go assassinate that person. You'd have to arrest them and prosecute
them. The whole pesky due process thing.
Yeah, right. And in the case of Venezuela and Maduro, you know, President Trump and his national security team decided they were going to be the judge, jury, and executioners of Venezuela, Maduro, and the crews of small boats that were allegedly carrying drugs towards the United States. So Trump has relegated all of these kind of powers to himself now. He wants to be king. He wants to make the rules. He has said none of the kind of restrictions of international law and domestic law really apply to me. And this is what was so surprising. This is what is different. Presidents before him have invaded Latin America, have intervened covertly in Latin America, but there's always been a fig leaf and a lip service paid to the rules of the international community. And Trump is saying those rules do not apply to me, and that makes him truly the most dangerous president of the United States that Latin America and the rest of the world has ever faced.
Why? I mean, if other U.S. presidents have engaged in similarly illegal actions through more covert means, regime changes, acts of terrorism, etc., but without the kind of spotlight on it, couldn't those be more dangerous? I mean, is there something about Trump's shamelessness that makes it more visible to the public and more easy to manage or contain?
Well, it doesn't make it more easy to manage. It certainly doesn't make it more easy to contain. That's the difference. He's untethered, uncontrolled, uncontained, unregulated, unbalanced, can we say, yeah, as well. And that's what makes him, I would argue, quite different from other presidents who at least understood that there were domestic pressures, U.S. law, international law, a structure that had to be respected, even if you were going to covertly circumvent that structure. And now the structure means nothing. And it's just, so I think the sense that people are feeling now with Trump talking about seizing Greenland, still making threats towards Canada, by the way, putting Cuba in the crosshairs of his new Dunroe Doctrine, of seizing control of Latin America. This is what is frightening, I think.
One of the ways that Trump has done this, and we've seen this in other parts of the world, is the security logic, that this is a necessity for national security. We've seen that be used to transfer people to El Salvador's CECOT prison. We've seen it for the actions that just happened in Venezuela. What is the relationship between this discourse of security and some of the actions we're seeing by the Trump administration?
National security has always been kind of the go-to excuse for U.S. presidents, you know, to justify the actions that they wanted to take in various parts of the world, whether it's Vietnam or
the Middle East,
the Middle East, or now Greenland, which Trump is focusing on national security, even though there's no national security threat for the moment that exists. And it's often been specious. The United States has intervened in Latin America before the Cold War, during the Cold War, and now after the Cold War. Latin America is an issue of geostrategic proximity to the United States. And the United States, going way back to the 1800s, has exercised what political scientists call the hegemonic presumption, the might makes right argument that this is our territory and we're going to control it. We're going to control it because it gives us natural resources. We're going to control it because our corporations can make money. We're going to control it because we don't want other colonial powers or neocolonial powers to control it. And that means we don't want independent sovereign states. And to the degree the United States can, it has tried to limit the independence and sovereignty of Latin American states for almost 200 years now.
Talk to me first about that natural resource piece that you raise. From what you've written, this is not a fight for democracy. This is not a fight to secure the nation's borders. This is not a war against drugs. This is a fight for resources.
Besides the national security argument, the United States and presidents and secretaries of states, you know, claim, well, we're promoting democracy in Latin America, and then they turn around and install and support, you know, ruthless, brutal generals such as Augusto Pinochet in Chile, the generals in Guatemala after the overthrow of Arbenz in 1954, or the junta in Argentina in the mid-1970s. And so, you know, that's obviously not supporting democracy. It's supporting dictators who would be more likely to do the bidding of the United States during the Cold War, you know, the influence of the Soviet Union or the left in Latin America. What was, you know, stunning about Trump's position on Venezuela is he didn't mention democracy or human rights a single time during that Saturday press conference. He trumpeted, the great victory of the U.S. military forces and going in, sweeping in, taking out Maduro, and now seizing control of the entire country and its main resource, which is the way we plan to control it. I call this remote control imperialism. Because Trump and Marco Rubio, they're going to be controlling the levers of power and the economics of Venezuela from a distance. We're not going to have troops on the ground there. We're not going to risk human lives. Trump is twisting the arms of the oil executives to go in and spend the money to modernize Venezuela's oil industry so that he doesn't have to spend tax dollars on this. And then he's going to take the revenues, which he already has, about $300 million just in just a couple weeks now of revenues from the oil that they've seized, and keep some of it for whatever he wants and give some of it back to whoever does his bidding in Venezuela. And that's a form of control over these countries that is also kind of new and modern and different.
Inside of Trump's camp, there seem to be at least two communities. There are the people who are thinking about money. They're thinking about how they can monetize detention and deportation and, of course, oil. But then there are the Marco Rubios of the world who seem to be much more ideological. He seems to be much more on an anti-communism campaign than a financial one. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, who's winning that war inside?
I don't think there's really a war inside the Trump administration. I think there are different strategies and different strategists. I think Marco Rubio comes across as kind of the only adult in the room, frankly, because he kind of has a foundation of sanity, even as hardline and conservative as he is. Yeah. There's no doubt, however, that Marco Rubio's motivations are political, not ideological, political. And he has, his entire political trajectory has been based on trying to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, trying to roll back the Cuban Revolution, seizing that Cold War trophy for himself. And now that he is both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, he has the levers of power to do so. This is his big opportunity to use the cutoff of oil from Venezuela to Cuba to kind of push Cuba to the edge. It's not in the U.S. interest that Cuba becomes a failed state because that's a lot of pieces that one has to pick up, and that would a failed state there would mean a collapse of the state, social violence, mass amounts of refugees trying to come to the United States, a lot of pieces to pick up. So like they're doing in Venezuela, where they're taking this kind of incremental position, you know, we're going to leave the structures of power more or less intact, decapitated, Maduro's here, but his Maduristas are still there, and we're going to move this forward slowly. In Cuba, I see them doing something similar, pressuring Cuba, trying to force Cuba into capitulation, a deal, as Trump has said, that meets what they want and what Rubio wants and Trump wants.
If the goal of these political and ideologically driven people is regime change, is this Cold War trophy that you're talking about. Would it be fair to say they're losing right now? I mean, even when you capture Maduro and you have Delcy Rodriguez effectively manning the same ship, effectively pushing the same ideological and political infrastructure forward, you haven't won there. Until Cuba somehow shifts its political direction, you haven't won there. I mean, are the ideologues losing?
I don't know if I can say this on your show, that the United States and Venezuela today has that country, you know, by the cojones, because the seizure of Venezuela's really only significant economic resource, oil, and having that under the complete control of the United States right now gives the United States a lot of power. And it has power, if it chooses to exercise it, over the other Latin American countries, whether it's Cuba or Colombia or Mexico. We have our military might, and Trump has asserted we have our, you know, geographic and superpower right to simply control this region as our own. And, you know, will that create pushback? Sure. And will that create resentment and upheaval and organized resistance? Eventually, we've gone through that cycle historically. That's how we came to have what Franklin Roosevelt called the good neighbor policy, after the whole era of raw, overt, gunboat diplomacy imperialism in the region. And so, yes, we could cycle back through that, but that takes a long time. For the current day, the United States is throwing its weight around, and that weight is considerable in this region.
But if the weight is largely attributable to a desire for oil, then it seems like the U.S. could be indifferent to who's in charge as long as they get access to the resource.
It's a desire for control, and that is what the United States is exercising now in Venezuela. Delcy Rodriguez can say what she wants. She can mobilize her constituents to continue to verbally be anti-imperialist. But at the moment, she has to yield to what Trump wants, which is control of the oil and basically Venezuela's economic future. Her ideology doesn't really make a difference. Whether there's elections at this point doesn't seem to make a difference. But you can see how there'll be an evolution of this influence and control over Venezuela and other countries as well. So it's a little too soon to say Trump is going to stop here and leave her in place forever. We have to see what's going to happen over the next 3 years. And I can tell you, you know, the rest of Latin America is pretty gravely concerned about this situation.
Help me understand why. You've talked a little bit about Cuba, which we'll revisit, but all of Latin America seems to be imperiled by this move that you called it maybe a history-changing turn in Latin America. I'm talking about January 3rd. Why?
Well, it is a history-changing term, but it's also a turn that has happened before. So there's a famous expression in Mexico and all of Latin America: they never remember and we never forget. Latin Americans have this sense of history. They have a sense of the kind of imperialist control that they suffered through in the 1800s and early 1900s. It's, you know, really only in the last 60 or so years since the 1940s that Latin America has had a sense of independence and sovereignty. After World War II in particular. And that, of course, has been severely punctured and damaged by U.S. covert operations in Chile and Guatemala, Cuba, and overt intervention in the Bay of Pigs and the Dominican Republic and the seizure of Noriega in 1989 in Panama. But here you have a president who doesn't care about anything but really demonstrations of power and control. He's a wannabe emperor, and emperors need empires. And that is what Trump is after. He wants everybody to take a knee, bend the knee, and pledge allegiance to the mad king of the North. You know, there's a reason why Latin Americans began to refer in the late 1800s, early 1900s to the United States as the Colossus of the North. Mm. And that is because we have behaved this way in the past, and now we're asserting that dominion again in the present day.
I want to talk a little bit more about the implications of this moment for Latin America. You've been talking a lot about Cuba. Obviously, that's one of your areas of expertise. Cuba relies on Venezuela for cheap oil. It is a vital resource. There is no doubt that a compromised Venezuela means a compromised Cuba. But just how compromised could Cuba be? Just how unstable or destabilized could Cuba become if things stay on the same course?
So before all this happened, Cuba was already teetering on the edge. It already has an economy that has been crushed by U.S. sanctions, by the aftermath of the COVID crisis, the pandemic, by, you know, to be honest, incredible mismanagement by the Communist Party leadership of the economic situation, a reluctance to move forward and modernize the Cuban economy, allow the private sector to kind of, you know, create the development that Cuba needs. Cuba has experienced the largest exodus of its population. Close to 2 million people have left since 2021, I think, over the last 4 or 5 years. It was a real crisis before all this happened. Venezuela, because of its own economic crisis, had reduced significantly by almost two-thirds the amount of oil that it was shipping to Cuba, down from 100,000 barrels a day to somewhere around 30,000 barrels a day. That oil was not just cheap, Mark, it was free, in a sense that Cuba bartered for it. It traded human services, security personnel, technicians, teams of medical doctors, thousands of doctors working in Venezuela, in return for that oil. They didn't have to pay for it. And unbelievably, even with the shortages of oil that they have had all this time and the rolling blackouts that exist every day in Cuba, Cuba was taking some of the oil that Venezuela was giving to it and selling it to China so that Cuba would have foreign exchange capital to buy some of the other things they needed, food, medicine, the basic needs of the Cuban people. And now they don't have any of that. They are going to be forced to try and talk some other oil supplier into giving them credit to buy oil, and it's not clear that that's going to be possible.
What about Colombia and Mexico? Both of those countries have had fairly rocky relations as of late with the U.S. The most recent events can't be good for them. What's your forecast?
You know, Trump has a kind of an attention deficit disorder when it comes to focusing on one thing and another. He gets up in the morning and he reads other people's tweets and maybe they set him off. He certainly feels, I think, emboldened and entitled to assert his powers over other countries. So if he wants something from Colombia, he wants something from Mexico, he is twisting arms. So far, both Colombia's leadership and Mexico's leadership have kind of taken a deft negotiating tactic towards him. They've reached out to him. They've talked to him. They've met with him. It's unclear whether this will keep the status quo as it is or whether he'll return to threats of demonstrations of U.S. power. I just think that we are entering a period of instability and grave concern in the aftermath of Venezuela, and that I don't believe I'm alone in feeling this. I think all of Latin America feels that way, and frankly, all of the world feels that way. The Prime Minister of Canada just last week made an extraordinary speech saying that there'd been a rupture of the world order.
That's not hyperbolic?
No, I don't think so. I think it's kind of a last gasp effort by sane international leaders, such as the leadership of Canada, such as the leadership of NATO and the European countries, to basically say the Trump administration is reconfiguring the power structures of the entire world, and what we have come to understand to be that the world order is coming to an end, and what is going to look like tomorrow.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Really good to be here. Thank you.